Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
So I think that the best thing a manager of managers could do is to provide stability, show up for the one-on-ones, hold space for what they're frustrated with or anxious about, and appreciate what they're doing well. You know, I mean, this is like ad nauseum feedback conversation stuff, but don't only say when things are not well. They also give plus one to things that are going well so that they know to continue that behavior. And it is possible that they will not confide in you for a while. They might be like, no, it's all looking good. It's all looking good. Because they don't want to be seen as an imposter and they don't want their boss to know that actually they're really anxious about it. But that's where the trust building work comes in.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of growing software engineering teams. I'm Aaron Syme, here with my co-host, David Alfaro. David, what do you think is one of the hardest things for new engineering managers?
It's realizing that they have a new identity. Well, I mean, that's to be more precise, is that they have grown. So the identity is not the same, it's grown. And because it's a new thing, they struggle to the emotional burden of doing new things with the old bodies of the coworkers before. And the second thing is what happens next. I mean, how I keep growing. Mm-hmm. So how I do a good job right now in my new role that I didn't know how to do before, and now how I keep growing, and what happens with all the new situations that it entails. That needs coaching, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that new identity is really, really key. And that's definitely something we talked with our guest today, Jen Derry, about. And she talked about new managers being worried about their as their identity changes, their relationship changing with their peers, with their friends that they work with when they become a manager over them. And that definitely happened to me, as I share in the episode. And something you and I have talked about in general before on the Scaling Tech Podcast is about, you know, like how little training was offered for new managers when you and I were coming up through the ranks early in our career. And I'm really glad to see that that dynamic has changed. And there's a lot more resources out there now for new managers. And certainly what Jen talks with us about in this episode and what she offers through her website and her courses is really a great step in the right direction that I wish we had that sort of thing earlier in our career. What's something else you found interesting about this conversation or that people should be on the lookout for in this episode?
Well, a couple of things. First is it's something that you will see at the beginning of the episode is the interesting role that emotions play in all of this. So it seems like for the first time in our profession, we are talking about emotions. Yeah. So that was a very interesting part because it was addressing the right way. And then for me, that's all good. I mean, how do we avoid being touchy-feely and set boundaries?
Yeah.
That are effective so we don't stop caring about productivity. I mean, right. We still take care of how the other person feels, but yeah. But productivity is what trumps everything else. So how we set boundaries. So I like that very much.
Yeah, I really appreciated how you brought that up, the emotional aspect early in our conversation with Jen, and then also, you know, towards the end, kind of brought it back to that concept of what are those boundaries and how do we balance that, because the person and their productivity are both important to the organization, but it is a tricky balance to strike. And that's particularly important with for managers to know how to do with the people that report to them, and then also for first-time managers to sort of to know and to deal with in their own role changes, and you know, as their identity there is changing through adopting this new role of being a new engineering manager. And so let's get to our interview with Jen. Leadership coach Jen Derry is founder of Plucky, where she works with individuals and companies to create healthy dynamics at work. She's also host of the Be Plucky podcast, where she interviews managers and engineering leaders about workplace topics that require resilience and perspective. From coaching to consulting, Plucky helps leaders, managers, teams, and employees find ways to be successful together. She leads virtual training cohorts for new managers, working primarily in the tech sector, but also with tech-adjacent companies. She lives in Arlington, Virginia, with her husband and young sons. Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, Jen.
Thank you, gentlemen. Very happy to be here today.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here today. Let's start with a little bit about how you got into coaching. David and I have both been coaches in our past and in different ways around like agile process managing, but there's, you know, coaching is such an all-encompassing term. I've been a coach. I've hired coaches for different reasons. I mean, there's all sorts of things you can do as a coach. So you've been coaching managers for over 10 years now, I believe, having founded Plucky in 2013?
Yeah, Plucky will be 10 in about 6 weeks. Yep.
Awesome. So let's start with a little bit more about your journey to being Plucky. When did you get into coaching? What types of clients do you work with?
Yeah, great question. So previous to Plucky, I worked at a digital agency in New York, and I was a director of employee development there. So what that meant is that I was doing the work of the verb coaching, but I didn't use that verb. It was hearing feedback. It was distributing feedback. It was taking someone out to coffee, hiring, retention, recruiting, all this kind of stuff. And I didn't know I wanted to be a coach. That was not the vibe. The thing was, I kept going to conferences with agency owners, and they kept having the same people problems. So they did not even necessarily have a director of employee development. Maybe they had what they would call people ops or operations at that point. We're talking like 2013, right? Or even earlier than that when I was at the agency. And I was like, I think I could help you. So pretty much same timing as I became a parent, I went on a maternity leave, had some life thinking, and decided, let me try my own thing. And in the very beginning, I thought, well, I will consult almost as like an external director of employee development for smaller teams that probably wouldn't have the budget for a full-time salary for that. But they could use me to sort of come in and do coffee chats or 30-minute sessions with each of their leadership team members once a month, things like that. And then I really felt like the verb was coaching, but I moved from Brooklyn to Berkeley, California, and I was like, if I move to Berkeley and I become a coach, like I just was really resistant to what that would mean identity-wise. You move to Berkeley, everyone's like, I'm a life coach now, come you know, do my yoga retreat and the ocean. And like not too much shade in that direction. There's a lot of people that make their life like that. But you got to remember that in 2013, nobody had a coach. Yeah. You had a consultant maybe, but you didn't use the word coach. And because you can't get a degree in coaching, you can certainly get certifications, but there's no on-ramp that is like the same. So Aaron, you're like kind of describing different folks you've worked with, coaches, consultants, and whatnot. And at least back in that time, people didn't have professional development budget for things like that. You wanted to buy a book on Python? Sure, here's $40 for it. But you want to spend $1,000 on coaching? That was not yet a thing. It was conference season, right? That landscape has changed quite a bit. So what I found is that a year and a half into Plucky, what people were actually asking for was coaching. So I put it on my website and people bought it. And then I was a coach. That's kind of how it went.
I want to ask for permission to talk about your postpartum depression. Can I?
Please do. Of course.
Okay. When I wrote your blog post about your journey, two important things were highlights for me. The first one, it is rare to find a coach, a person that knows of the, I mean, that talks about coaching in a way that gives an important role to the feelings, to the emotions of people. So that's why when you said and I had this postpartum depression.
Yeah.
So they paid attention to that. And then you mentioned that that led you to a transformation, to find your own identity. So that was the first thing that was interesting. And I want to ask you, maybe as we go along, but the importance and the proper role of emotions when assessing yourself. I think it's fantastic the way you put it, the example that you gave. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is the process that transformation process that you experienced, you would have appreciated if you had a coach for that. And I think that you are taking that as part of the process you give to other people, right?
Yeah, David, that is such a killer question. And I really appreciate you pointing that out, because there's like 10 directions my brain is going, but I'll try to go somewhat logically. Sometimes people think, this is the difference between coaching and consulting. Consulting is like, excuse me, I have a problem. Consultant is like, here is your answer. A coach to me is, hey, I have a problem. A coach says, what do you think the answer would be? Because definitely we know way more often than we think what actually the answer is. We just need either permission or a little brainstormy thing, or maybe to unpack emotion, to your point, David. A coach to me is someone that is going to highlight the fact that you probably know more than you think. So let's squeeze you of that. And then let's make a plan for sort of how to act on that. And that is two very different styles of interaction in a, I don't know if I want to say client services vibe, but the thing with emotions and recognizing that and putting that, I'll say vulnerability out there, although obviously I can speak about that without, that's fine. I publicly speak about that all the time. If I was a consultant, I'm not sure if I could talk about that. Consultant, therefore, is the person who holds the wisdom and the direction and the here's the framework you need. As a coach, I think it was a good tone to set, even though, of course, it was subconscious, right, back at that point. But it was a good tone to set that's like, I don't know everything, but I sure as hell have lived through some stuff. And then just to fast forward to something else we might get to, postpartum depression was super challenging, as was that on-ramp to parenting for me. Maybe some of your listeners agree on their story, too. Fast forward 6 years, then I am diagnosed with a brain tumor in 2016. That was also obviously a big deal. And I had a craniotomy 2 weeks later. And I just literally yesterday finished writing a memoir about that experience. And it's about a diagnosis, obviously, and seeing that through and parenting two young kids. But it's also about Plucky and the risks I ended up taking after that. Because when you're almost dead, you're like, well, who cares if no one buys a ticket? Why don't I try something? You know, all of a sudden, it was this real freedom, I guess I'll say, to take risks. And as I was in ICU at some point, it occurred to me, people are in meetings right now. People are making strategic plans for the next quarter. None of that matters. Like at that moment, I had a real perspective on that. And so I'll come back when the book is out, right, to talk about it all. But I do, as I put the finishing touches on yesterday, and it's prepared now to go to beta readers this weekend, I am curious to know what will come out of that. Like as the coach now, I'm opening a whole memoir of my journey of being angry, but then also okay. What will that do for my clients? Will they feel closer, or will they be like, this is TML or, oh my God.
TMI.
TMI. Thank you. Sorry. Yes, exactly. TMI. Right. Like what the reaction is going to be. I don't know. And maybe that emotion will have overstepped there. I hope not, but yeah.
I want to give you one second because this is, for me, it's just fascinating. The way I see emotions is that they are signposts to our values. So it is a good way to, if you feel something, the worst that you can do is avoid that or evade that. So by analyzing what you feel, you discover what is the value that is at play at this moment. And navigating that helps you to define what is your central purpose, and then you just take the risk, because now you have discovered what you want. So, I mean, a simple way to put it is happiness, even is a stain of mine. Mm. At the end of the day, we are looking for a state of mind that makes us feel good. So emotions are important.
Absolutely. And then do you honor your value or emotion, or do you bruise your value or emotion?
Right.
I would say that's the choice in those moments. And the other thing is not to, you know, make it all sound cheery, but there will be times when you have to bruise your value for a lot of reasons. You need money. You can't quit that job just yet. You need healthcare in this country. There's a lot of logistical things that sometimes mean that we should not betray who we are, but it just means that in terms of priority, it might fall second or third for a little while.
Well, temporarily, at least.
I mean,
it is not that you are denying. It is like, I mean, for now, I don't have the time to give attention to this, but I know it's important.
And I hear
it's
it.
There.
Yeah.
I hear it. It's there. Okay, I'll be back. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I love this topic that we've been covering so far, which is really more around emotions. And it's almost like we're having a well-being podcast here, but this is an engineering management podcast, but well-being is really important to that too, right? Because we can't entirely separate our personality or our personal lives from our professional work. Something I've seen you write about, Jen, I want to ask about, seems to fit here too, is this concept of adult development. Can you talk about adult development and how does that relate to your coaching?
Yeah, I was thinking about adult development when my kids were like in daycare, let's say preschool, where it was very normal to have a conversation with a teacher or a pediatrician, of course, about, oh, they're not walking yet, or, oh no, but they only have one tooth, you know, this kind of stuff. Childhood development was something that was a constant conversation in the background of their growth. And it wasn't a problem to talk about. In fact, it was like the expected behavior. Oh, this, you know, living being is going to be evolving and growing. And therefore, this conversation is necessary to make sure they're on track. Then you graduate high school and people are like, good luck. Best of luck. I mean, I guess you've grown as tall as you might be. You've got your teeth or not, you know, whatever is going to be. And we are spit out into sort of this assumed adult state that doesn't allow for the same kind of checking up. And I felt like it was a missed opportunity to assume that we were fully done when we're 18 or even whatever you want to say, 22, if you go to college, things like that. And so my approach to coaching and kind of just handling people in general is the idea that that development continues. Now, you're going to hear that people get budget for development and professional growth and things like that. But of course, your age or your tenure in an industry doesn't dictate what lesson you're on, right? We're all going to have that growth experience, but it'll be in different order. And it's kind of messy to figure out who's doing what. To your point a minute ago, the emotional experiences or just the personal experiences are going to intersect sometimes with what shows up at work. And so if you start to like now amp this up to things like how you are as a leader, how you handle power, how you handle conflict, this stuff is definitely something worth checking in on. And as an adult, if you've never experienced conflict, I'm not sure where you've been living. So this notion of providing support for those times, whether that's a class ahead of time, right, early in someone's career, hey, let's get a feedback class in or, you know, whatever it is. Or, of course, more of an acute situation later with coaching. You've got a toxic team member. You've got conflict with someone. Let's address that. And let's not say this is the bad side of things, but just, oh, you're going through that phase. You're going through that leadership phase or absorbing authority phase or, you know, this sort of thing. And I felt like that approach was just more reasonable when it came to humans. It has been interesting to watch over 10 years where the budget lies. So like I said, 10 years ago, if you wanted a book on whatever, sysadminness, you know, you could probably get $50 to get the book. You might even be able to get some money to go to a conference. Today, many places don't bat an eyelash if you want to use your funds towards coaching. Like that has really culturally become a norm. And even the smaller places that maybe can't do it all the time, even if, you know, I have some clients that get, I don't know, $600 a year, they'll use it for a few sessions and, they are always happy to have spent that time with a personal conversation about their challenges as opposed to like a webinar, which is a little more broad.
Yeah. And I think this is especially important with, as you go sort of up the hierarchy in an organization with managers and executives. I mean, for my part, I've used multiple different types of coaches and consultants in the past, because when, you know, as David and I are, when you're kind of at the top of your organization, when you're a co-founder and entrepreneur, you know, who do you ask for advice? Maybe you have a board of directors or investors, but, you know, it's not always necessarily a neutral or a safe space to have a really deep conversation, right? So I think it's certainly over the course of my career, I've seen it become more and more acceptable and encouraged, and I've taken advantage of doing that. And, you know, that's important for managers throughout the organization and, you know, people throughout the organization, really. So let's talk about what do, because a lot of your work, you are specializing in new managers, right? Helping them with that transition. So what do new managers struggle with the most, and how can we as more experienced managers help them? Mm.
Well, I think if I had to pin it to one, new managers struggle with a lot, but if I had to put it to one concept, I would say they struggle with being liked over being respected.
Yeah.
People have a really hard time, especially, let's just take a situation which is very common, which is that you're promoted from within. So you don't get a new job at a new company. You are an IC, maybe a senior IC at that point. And now all of a sudden you're in charge of the other ICs. This is like triple black diamond level management, because they used to be your friends and they used to be your peers. And now you could theoretically fire them or get them more money, or you're responsible for their performance reviews. And you see them at angles that you didn't before. That's really hard. And that is an identity shift. So the reason it's so hard sometimes to become a manager is you have to re-see yourself with the same audience. It's a tiny bit easier if maybe you quit your job and get to be a new manager job somewhere else, but it's real hard to be hired from the external if you've never been a manager before and they want you to walk in and do that on day one. So this, the identity stuff follows you because you were funny and jokey and friends, and maybe they came to your wedding, or maybe they had a baby shower for you. You know, this kind of cultural stuff with that is so beautiful about teams, and everybody's on the same side and we're running for a deadline or whatever it is. And one of the things I kind of break it to, I teach a class called So Now You're a Manager, specifically for this population. It's people that are within their first 3 years traditionally of management. And I always say, congratulations, you have to find new friends. Like, I don't want to be a buzzkill. And I am not saying you can't have some relationship. Of course, these people that have meant so much to you. But you need peers, man. You need a new set of peers, because to your point, the confidentiality you might need to share, that concern or context, you're going to have visibility into new numbers, how much people make. I remember there was a client a while ago who, they had an office building. She got promoted into management. She was like, it is so expensive to rent space. And I was like, yeah. You're not your founders are not fat cats over here just like raking in and like throwing dollars around. It costs money to run a business. And so sometimes that maturity moment, or just I don't want to throw shade downstream, right? I don't want to say ICs are not mature, but that perspective shift, maybe I'll say, can be a huge just like bump in the road. And I think people want to hold on to those relationships and be liked. And sometimes what that new identity means is that you're going to have to draw some boundaries. You're going to have some new expectations. All of that is going to shift a little. And sometimes people feel like they sell out, like they went corporate, they work for the man, you know, whatever phrase you want to say. I used to be the maker. Now I do the paperwork for the makers, you know, all this kind of stuff. So there's a healthy amount of things to process in a new manager training.
I can't tell you how much that rings true for me. I mean, I was thinking actually before we were recording this, that the first time I was offered a management position, I turned it down for the exact reason you just said. I remember saying to my supervisors, these people are my friends. I don't know if I want to be their manager or not. And so I missed that opportunity, which looking back on it, you know, it was pretty unusual because I'm a pretty ambitious person. But a year later, they kind of asked me again. They're like, how about now? Could really, you know, use somebody in this role now. And then I did it. And it was a good shift, but it was a mindset shift for sure. Now, for those of us who now are managing managers, mm-hmm. and I'm managing a new manager for the first time, let's say, they are a manager for the first time and I am managing them. What am I probably not doing that I should be to help them in that new role, to help them make that transition?
Well, now we get meta, right? Because you are not the new manager, you are managing the new manager. So theoretically, you've been through some of these tricks before and you have had an identity shift. I think what's different here, what we're talking about, right, is that I would be third party. So I can, if they want to quit their job, I don't have any vested interest in that or not. I'm the coach. They don't have me internal. If you're internal and you're their manager of managers, then you don't have the same freedom flex that I might have to sort of counsel them. That said, you have a totally better understanding of the culture you're in, the cast of characters that are around you, who you trust, who's prickly, things like that. So I think that the best thing a manager of managers could do is to provide stability, show up for the one-on-ones, hold space for what they're frustrated with or anxious about, and appreciate what they're doing well. You know, I mean, this is like ad nauseum feedback conversation stuff, but don't only say when things are not well. They also give plus one to things that are going well so that they know to continue that behavior. And it is possible that they will not confide in you for a while. They might be like, no, it's all looking good. It's all looking good. Because they don't want to be seen as an imposter and they don't want their boss to know that actually they're really anxious about it. But that's where the trust building work comes in. And so manager, I think that building trust is, building trust with regard to, or with an eye on responsibility, right? You've got stuff to ship and things to move forward as well. But I always tell my new managers, you are a double major in building trust and finding opportunities. That's your deal. Every moment of the day, you're doing one or the other. And I think the same is true for managers and more senior leadership as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I think it's, for me as a manager of managers, I'm often very, very delivery focused in the things that we need to get done. Probably more focused on that finding opportunities than building trust side of management would be maybe my default position if I'm not consciously, thinking to, hey, let's just do a check-in, even though I don't have a deadline that I need to ask you about, right?
Yeah.
And so, showing up with those one-on-ones you said, I think is really good. It was something I really liked about your website and some of the tools that you offer through that are these card packs. I bought some and I'm starting to share them within our team as well. These little decks of manager one-on-one cards. This is for the manager pack. So this would be like for me as a manager of a manager, right? But others are for more general purpose one-on-ones or for mentoring. But what I love about it is, especially for someone like me who I may be very delivery focused, if I pull a card out of here, it's going to help me think of a question I need to ask that's maybe a little less in the moment, a little more about how things are going in general. If you don't mind, I grabbed a couple out of here and I'll read one or two of them just to give people a taste of it. So like, I love this question that was under these have like some subheaders in them. Yeah. Within the deck. So this one is under the subheader of self-care. And the question I should be asking my manager who reports to me in this one-on-one, what are you procrastinating right now? I love that question. And then like a secondary follow-up question here, what would make it easier to get moving on that? So I like that. I mean, depending on the person's personality, they might take that question in a couple ways maybe, but I think it's really good to, it's, you're asking it, I think, in a way there that helps them understand you're trying to help them. Mm-hmm. And also you're recognizing that, the struggle is real sometimes. We're all procrastinating on something. So why are we? Is it because it's not important or is it because it's really important, but we're afraid of doing it or we don't feel like we have the tools to do that? Getting back to that emotional component, right?
I was going to say, yes, a very universal question. And to David's point earlier, this to me is where the emotional stuff can kind of be a blurry line at work. Where this question about what are you procrastinating right now, your report has the invitation to say something at work or something elsewhere. You could imagine somebody making a joke about, what am I procrastinating right now? God, I got to make a follow-up dentist appointment. That is truly the thing I wake up every day thinking about, right? I mean, they could make, and that would be a little door into who they are outside of work, which is so, again, universal, like, oh God, call the dentist. What? Pause this meeting, go call, come back in 10 minutes. You know, like, it's joyful. It's fun. You're a whole person. Or they could say, I'm procrastinating giving feedback to my report because they're very abrasive and I know it's not going to go well. This now opens the door for you as a manager to walk them through, all right, well, let's make a plan. What's your goal of the conversation? What do you want to walk out with? How do we make a structure that you're going to, okay, cool. Here's how I'm going to announce the feedback. And then how am I going to listen? And then how do you try to stretch towards the goal and what's reasonable? Huge learning moment for you as a manager. And the thing is about those questions, and I'm glad you appreciate where they're coming from, is that sometimes when you're busy, you're really just focusing on producing and billing if you're a client services firm and, you know, shipping stuff. And it's not that that's not part of your job. It's just that there's this invisible data all over the place where you could tell this person is struggling because they just had a baby. They're tired. Okay, cool. It's not that they're pissed at me. It's not that they're mad at the team, right? And you can start to discern. It's almost like you have these secret glasses you put on and you understand, well, these two have beef, so I'm not going to put them on the same project right now or whatever. It's this extra data, extra information that's just flying around that you could account for. And it will probably mean better work, more efficiency, and better productivity. I also want to be clear and say you're not a therapist as a manager. And there is a boundary that you will need to hold at some point and gently refer someone to HR or therapy if it gets to that point. But you can and should have some flex into this person having emotions that are really freaking relevant at work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, another one here that I really liked that somewhat related to that, I mean, I could imagine someone who is struggling with these issues maybe outside of work that mm-hmm. as a manager are not your domain to really help them with. They, you know, but it certainly gets into how they perform and things that they're working on and maybe struggling with. So this question of, tell me what would be a relief to delegate? You know, I think to me, delegation is always an area I've struggled with the most as a manager. I'm not great at delegating, but as I've gotten better, I've tried to get better also at encouraging the people who report to me to delegate. Right. And so I love this question of just, and the way it's phrased there of what would be a relief to you to delegate, you know?
Yeah. There's no shaming in it either. Right. It's like, I'm not checking up on you and preparing information for your performance review. It's just a genuine, like, what's on your plate that you kind of wish you could get off. And then again, you might be able to help problem solve there. Well, that seems easy. What about Joey? He seems like he has an extra time, a little bit of time next week. Could we, you know, and sometimes you're just so in it, you don't see those potential solutions to things. I also think that an in-house manager, right? Like you versus me, man, you have such a potential to be a great mentor to the people that report to you, a great model. You have the ability to be like, let me tell you a story about procrastination, my friend. And I don't want you to be the old guy, you know, who's stroking your beard with wisdom, but.
I do. How did you know I do that? I do that.
Just saying, classic move. But for you to say, no, let me just tell you a story about when I procrastinated early in my management career. And now there's camaraderie, there's resonance. They understand, oh, okay, they had a similar path to me. I remember when I started Plucky, so I said I was at a client services firm, and my son turned one about a month after I started Plucky. So we had a little birthday party. And my old boss came, he was the president of the company. And, you know, he was like, hi, happy birthday, how's Plucky? And I was like, I don't have any clients yet. Okay. This is 1 month in. And he was like, oh, Jen, that's not what you're doing right now. You're just planting seeds. And I was like, oh my God. It was so permission granting, especially because I had just left his organization, right? Like I wanted there to be no beef. And what he was telling me, and I think maybe he even, you know, told a little anecdote about it, but he was saying when I had first started a company, I was just planting seeds too. It doesn't have to be successful by having income on day one, or, you know, you probably have to have a loose boundary on when you've got to make some money, but it was like really the best thing he could have told me at that point, 4 weeks in. And you can see 10 years later, I still think about it.
Yeah, that's great advice. I love that line.
Building custom WebRTC video applications is hard, but your go live doesn't have to be stressful.
We thought we were ready to launch our video application, but we discovered it's a lot harder than we thought. Live video applications are not like building other web or mobile apps. Our team worked hard out there today, but we just didn't have all the right pieces. I'll tell you what we should have done. We should have brought in the live video experts from WebRTC Ventures.
If you're building a live video application, then trust the experts at WebRTC.Ventures to help you design, build, test, deploy, and manage your custom-built application, or integrate live video into your existing application. Contact us today at WebRTC.Ventures.
When you're coaching managers, talk a little bit about maybe it's a curriculum you follow. Like, how do you do homework, accountability in that, and tied into that, how do you balance what your client is bringing to the table that they want to talk about versus what you may be hearing they need to talk about?
Well, first of all, every person is different. Tomorrow, I think I have 5 coaching calls, which is a lot for me, each an hour. I usually have more like 2 and 3 a day, but every one of those 5 calls will be different. Mm-hmm. Some of them are going to talk for 80% of the hour. Some of them are I'm going to have to like, whoosh, you know, for listeners who are not watching, I am like reeling in a fish here with my hand. Like, come on, what else is going on? Say it out, right? They're all really different. Sometimes they come with a really proper little list of things they want to cover. This meeting was hard. This person is hard, you know, whatever. Some people just fly in from their last meeting. We talk about whatever was on fire lately, you know. And equally, sometimes at the end, there's an obvious homework. And sometimes people are like, brah, I got too much homework. Don't give me anything else. I'm going to pitch investors next week, or, you know, whatever. So the shape of all that is different. That said, I always start the session by saying, catch me up since last time a little bit. I have a couple of questions, probably following up on what we had talked about. And then I say, what do you want to talk about today? And so it is entirely their driving in terms of content. I don't have a curriculum per se, but the same stuff comes up all the time, right? Trusting yourself. Is this feedback valid or not? Where do you want to go with your life, your career? How do you handle conflicts? Like everything. Lately, in a post-COVID situation, are you burned out? Are you okay past burnout? Like, are you healed from burnout? Is your team burned out? Did you go through layoffs? I mean, welcome to 2023. That's a huge, huge thing. And for managers in particular, very often the ones that I'm working with who are newer managers did not make the call about who is getting laid off. So they are the messengers, but they did not make that decision. And that in itself is a mind fuck, to be honest, you know, where you have to validate and support the party line, but it wasn't your call. And maybe you would have chosen differently if you had been given some agency there.
Yeah. Wow. That's another one that rings really true for me. And, you know, especially what you and Devi were talking about earlier about times where, you know, how your emotions are key, as Devi said, emotions are signposts into your values. I love that phrase that Devi used. And Jen, you talked about times where you have to bruise your values a little bit temporarily. And that brought back a first-time manager type of scenario for me, where I was in almost the identical situation you just described. It wasn't 2023, but it certainly could have been.
Yeah.
This was almost 20 years ago, I think, early in my management career, where I was told, yes, you have to lay off this number of people from your team. That was my first experience doing that. It was an awful experience. Some of these people were my friends. And even worse, it was a situation where there was one clear person who I felt should be top of the list, and I was told is off the table, couldn't be part of the list. And that was very contrary to my values and to what I felt like everyone in the team would know was maybe not that I don't want to, it would be unfair for me to say the obvious choice, but everyone would have understood why if that, you know, choice were made.
Do you know why they were off the table? Can I ask that? Was it
friend of the owner?
Yeah. Politics. God.
Yeah. Yeah. That classic sort of stuff. And,
that's so JV, by the way.
Very JV. Yeah. I don't want to give away too much. People who know my background, people who know me well, know exactly what story I'm talking about because we've talked about it over beers before. And I kind of, you know, but I've shared this story with other people I've managed later on too. And, you know, in situations where I have then been the person telling a manager, unfortunately, you have to let go X number of people. But, you know, had some emotional conversations of then saying, but look, I want to tell you a story about when I did this for the first time and how awful it was. And I want to make sure you don't feel that way in the sense like this is going to be an awful experience for everybody. The person being laid off, the manager who has to do it, the executive who has to decide it. No one enjoys those moments. But you can approach them in maybe a little more ethical or kind ways, at least, than that first experience I had. So, you know, as the old guy stroking my beard with wisdom, as you said, you know, kind of saying, hey, you know, I want you to know that you have more agency in this decision. And I'm here to support you in it, not here to kind of, you know, crush you.
Maybe about to dry. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a hard situation.
It is. And I think that this year, at least, part of my role as a coach is to normalize what's going on, to say what you're going through is happening at many other companies, like all of them, you know, so that there is an ability for them to discern between my boss is a jerk or my company is messed up versus this is kind of an economic situation right now. I mean, whatever. I'm not an economist. I kind of feel like this whole thing got like a snowball effect by like the big important guys. Like, we have to do layoffs because we're so cool and we hired so much during COVID. And then everybody was like, us too. We're so cool.
Yeah, exactly. It feels that way sometimes.
Right. I mean, you know, don't at me from the economy people. But, but emotionally and human dynamic wise, I could say that, you know, that started to happen. And then My biggest, just I would say, problem with this past 8 months has been the fact that sometimes these layoffs have been such an easy out for performance management. Mm-hmm. So companies or teams that were not keeping up with performance, course correcting, letting go when it wasn't working out. This is like a real nice one-stop shopping for like, oh yeah, layoffs are really coming. And then, you know, a percentage of them, maybe higher than normal, are performance-based. And it's just that they kind of, I don't want to say wussed out, but they're conflating those two things. So therefore, you now have mixed messages to folks that genuinely, like financially, cannot have a job at the company with people who their performance was not great. And so that is a really mixed, braided strand of confusion as people are on their way out the door. You know, I don't know why I keep calling this imagined person Joey, but Joey over here is out the door because he sucked, you know, and just never got his stuff done on time. And I'm out the door at the same time, at the same day, but they told me it wasn't performance. It's just messy. It's hard to message.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to go back, if I may, to, let me rephrase this. I can see clearly how you as the company founder or a company manager, you want to see your people grow, and that encompasses, as we have discovered lately, the well-being of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see clearly how taking into account the well-being of your people is going to help you to be more productive at the end of the day. I mean, because you are taking into account that they are humans, mm-hmm. and they have life and life getting in the way and all of that. I can see clearly how that shift or that transition towards a better understanding of how a human works, mm-hmm. is important. At the same time, the limits. So you mentioned something interesting here is you are not their therapist, their mm-hmm. therapist. Mm-hmm. So that limit is quite important.
Yes.
It is the psychology. I mean, let me is at the end of the day, you are dealing with the conscious part of the person. I mean, mm-hmm. And you're making dealings and you're making transactions with the conscious part of the person. And the contract that is established between you and them is just from the conscious part. That is quite important here. If not, it will be a mess. So that's why you are not there. The therapist is important. When you are realizing that you are finding issues, and maybe we can enumerate a couple of them, that would be fantastic. If you are finding that that person is possibly facing a trauma, mm-hmm. I don't know, mm-hmm. That it goes beyond your abilities because you are not a therapist.
Yeah. Divorce is a great example.
For example. Right. I mean, and the other thing that is part of the limit is that, well, it's similar to what I said, is at the end of the day, you are expecting productivity from them. So if we are doing all these things, taking into account their humanity, it's because at the end of the day, I want more productivity.
Yes.
So the fact that I'm taking into account how you feel doesn't mean that I'm giving you a blank check to not be productive.
I'm so glad you're saying this, David, because it's very, so I'm from New York originally. Then we lived in Bay Area 7 years, so Berkeley, like I said. I am obviously very social emotional, right? Like I am very, let's think about the person, but I'm also from New York. And so I'm like, we gotta make the money. If we don't make the money, we don't have the jobs. If we don't have the jobs, you don't have healthcare. We are never in a conference room where I can ask you a question on a card. So yes, 100%. And actually, David, when you were like laying that out, which is like you as manager being open to absorbing more of the person than is just like code maker, right? Like you're saying, I agree. I will be here to see a person as more than just the exact number of dollars that they make. That person has to do the same. So an IC also has to understand, they don't have to fully empathize because they probably can't. They haven't been in a manager role, but they have to understand that you're a human too. And like I kind of made that reference a second ago when I said that, you know, my client realized how much money it is for a brick and mortar building, right? To pay rent on a building. You have to realize that your manager is probably also doing the best they can. And if you can just assume goodwill on all parts, which I guess you can't always, but if you could just generally assume goodwill, then they are also accounting for the fact that you might be going through a divorce, or you might be tired because you have a new baby, or all these sorts of things. And I am not convinced that we are teaching the world that message as well today as we are the opposite. I think we are certainly empowering leadership to be more open-minded and more well-rounded and more, you know, empathetic. And there is just a, I don't know what I want to say, like culture, I guess, of doubt of power. I mean, I say that and I wonder why, but you know, in the world, we're very suspicious of power right now. And we're very like, I mean, look, we got Musk and Zuckerberg this week, right? Like very suspicious, like these people who make all the decisions and have all the power, like, I don't necessarily know that they're also humans. They are not doing a great job at exposing that side of themselves or creating empathy lines or openings, I'll just say. So that is something that I think is real. And managers are in some cases bending over backwards, not to be therapist, but to be everything up to. And they're still getting shit on sometimes from their ICs. In fact, I was just writing curriculum for a class I'm teaching later this week called Leadership, Not People Management. So it's for people who are leaders, but not managers, which is its own sticky conundrum. And I was writing about power and I said, old school power versus power today. Old school power is like, I'm the boss. You'll do this, this, and then this. People are like, okay, no problem. Today, you're like, I'm in charge. People are like, congrats. You know, it's like, they're like, good job. What's the plan over here? Well, we'll see if I like it. You know, it's just a very different, this is a generational thing, and I'm not going to be an old lady and say back in the day, because I'm kind of into it also. But that power shit is showing up at work too. The cultural stuff going on in our country and in our world, the leaders or lack of leaders that we see that we want to model ourselves after, it's showing up here. It really is. And so it's going to be an opportunity on both sides to show empathy and ability to extend trust.
Right. I mean, in general, I like the thing that you said is like, that you can assume, I forget the exact word.
Goodwill,
but, I
mean, or good intent.
Goodwill, goodwill, good intent, or yeah, benevolence. I mean, it's I think is the rule of life, I think is you can assume that first, mm-hmm, or maybe it is good for you to assume that. It is not that you are shutting down your mind,
right,
for evidence towards the contrary. Is that the first assumption that you have when you are dealing with a new person, a new situation, is that, okay, let's assume goodwill here.
Mm-hmm.
But you keep your mind open,
right,
to the new evidence to see how goodwill is actually happening here. And then you adjust. I like that. I want to bring a specific example about the importance of coaching.
Do it.
It happens to us all the time. So we have clients that we bring software developers from Latin America, and yep, when we bring those Latin guys into their American team, so, and we are in the middle. So the question is, the eventual question is for everybody mm-hmm, is career path. Is like, eventually someone is going to say, hey, this guy, I'm doing a great job here.
Right.
And I feel motivated to grow. I am not content to be an average person, and I'm showing signs of being beyond average,
mm-hmm,
but I don't see a path to follow.
Yeah.
I don't know what is that path. How do I set it for myself? I don't know. How do I set it in a way that is aligned to company's goals, so I actually grow.
Right? Mm-hmm.
So that needs coaching.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, coaching for the company, coaching for the developer. I mean, because if that doesn't happen, what we're going to have is people misaligned.
Right. And retention issues.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me, and that could be a whole huge conversation about cross-cultural teams, what it's like to work with people, not only from different backgrounds, but in different time zones, all mm-hmm kinds of stuff. But in short, I think it would be a good exercise for literally any team to decide, let's define what good work is.
Right.
What does it mean to say we're doing good work, or we're doing our best work? And to come to each meeting and say, how can we do our best work this hour? What would that look like? You don't have to do it every single meeting at the beginning, but you know what I mean? At some regular cadence to ground yourselves in that. When it comes to connecting career path there, I think that the company sets the tone and expectation. So if you get promoted based on tenure, like the longer you stay, the more money you get paid, I don't necessarily think that's the smartest thing to do. But if you do it, just say it. Here's what happens. And if it's based on a different metric, then say that too, right? Set expectation. You'll get people as long as you get people. And then you'll have a strategy for finding new people or retaining. But being clear and communicative about that, I think, is probably your best bet. And the last thing I'll say about career path, and this could come from company side or individual side, is that career path does not only come from your company. Like, your employer is going to give you something. Yeah, for sure. But there's a crap ton of other stuff you can do that would be under the umbrella for career path. And I don't only mean speaking at conferences, although of course that's one, or writing or blog posting or making a podcast or all this kind of stuff. But certainly, you know, a lot of people do volunteering or mentoring or coaching or things like that on the side. It's all your damn career. Your employer doesn't have to be the only one sort of investing in you in that way. And so if the more we can do to sort of expand that definition, I think the better it is, honestly, for everybody, because you don't hold only the company accountable for that evolution.
That's a great point. Sadly, we are out of time, but we could do a whole episode just on career paths, and maybe we should with you sometime, Jen. This was a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed it. How can our listeners get in touch with you and learn more about your work?
Great question. I think the best idea, even if I was a listener and I was not myself, would be just to subscribe to my newsletter. I send it once a month. I tell a story about something going on in the world and I connect it back to work. And then I tell you what I have for sale, but I'm funny about it. And, you know, no pressure. You don't have to buy stuff from me, but if you want to, or you want to share it with somebody. So my newsletter is probably the best thing. beplucky.com/newsletter, but it's also on the front page. And then like we were talking earlier, I have a product line of one-on-one cards, and I have notebooks for managers to set up their weeks well, things like that. So you can go check out the shop. And on Instagram, I am bpluckster. Somebody took bplucky, so I'm bpluckster. And every Monday morning, I do a little video and I set the week up and I say some stuff that's going on and I try to give some perspective for us all starting the week off right.
Thank you so much, Jen. Really a pleasure to have you today on the Scaling Tech Podcast. Look forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks to both of you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us on the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Brought to you by agilityfeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally. For more information on today's episode and to submit your ideas for future guests, please visit scalingtechpod.com.